On this week's 51%, we meet women who have found approaches to coping with chronic pain.
I couldn't do anything because of the pain, but I couldn't do anything because of the pain meds either.
Hear about the culture of gender bias in STEM and listen to a woman's generational story turned into poetry. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Swallow. Nearly one in three Americans live with chronic pain, for which there is no quick fix. But pain experts generally agree that a low-tech approach focused on lifestyle changes can help. And while the treatments can be more expensive and less convenient than a bottle of pills, they can help patients get off addictive medications. Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman reports.
Kim Brown has a sideways curve in her spine that has caused pain for years, but it got much worse after an incident in 2010.
It was the simplest thing. I picked up a bag of garbage with my right hand.
And she immediately knew something was wrong.
It blew out a disc, and so that's when the pain really went extreme.
Brown was put on opioids like so many others who report to the doctor with pain. In a single year, healthcare providers write enough opioid prescriptions for every adult in the U.S. to have a bottle of pills. Each time Brown came back, still in pain, another opioid was added to the list.
Percocet, Vicodin, morphine, Dilaudid. So I was drugged constantly.
And the side effects, primarily constipation, caused such severe abdominal pain she could hardly walk.
It kills your life. It totally robs you of every aspect. I couldn't do anything because of the pain, but I couldn't do anything because of the pain meds either.
Brown tried to quit on her own, but after 9 days of nausea and fainting from withdrawal, she was back on the meds.
I finally went to my family doctor and said, look, I need help. I can't live like this anymore. And he referred me to Dr. McManus, and that's when life changed.
Dr. Dennis McManus is the director of the OSF Central Illinois Pain Center in Peoria. He specializes in helping chronic pain sufferers like Brown get off opioids.
From my perspective, if you stabilize the dose and slowly taper off, these patients do remarkably well.
McManus works with a team of providers who together help patients make lifestyle changes that reduce pain during everyday activities. This approach includes physical therapy, massage, nutrition counseling, and psychological therapy. He says real change takes a commitment from patients.
And most people really just want to have the magic wand that will get them all better. And I'm just trying to say, I don't have a magic wand, but I might have a way out of this jungle that you're in.
At the clinic, Brown met occupational therapist Gabe Stickling, who taught her things like how to properly lift heavy objects. During a visit, Stickling coaches Brown through an elliptical workout. He talks about how to safely keep exercising, even when she feels a twinge of pain.
Yeah, I can already feel it in my hip.
Okay, we'll go a few more minutes and kind of see how it goes here.
Okay.
He explains that people with chronic pain often avoid physical activity.
Because they're afraid they're going to injure themselves or damage their bodies.
Well, that's kind of where I'm at because there are so many things that I don't do because I don't want to hurt myself.
But inactivity can make the pain worse.
There's general agreement that kind of multidisciplinary or multimodal approach is really the gold standard treatment for chronic pain conditions.
That's Dr. Erin Krebs. She's a physician scientist at the Minneapolis VA healthcare system. Krebs recently authored the first long-term randomized trial of opioids for treating chronic back pain and arthritis. She found they are no better than non-opioid medications.
It's important to remember that the main treatments that are recommended for these pain conditions are not medication treatments.
But because non-drug treatments are hands-on and time-intensive, McManus says it can be hard to find a clinic that offers them and insurance that will cover them.
A lot cheaper to put someone on a chronic opioid. It's cheaper than having a whole bunch of people work with you.
But Krebs is hopeful things will change as communities see the hidden costs of opioids.
It's not just the price of the pills. It's also the price of the consequences when you over-rely on something.
Over the course of a 12-week program with McManus, Brown tapered off opioids. She says she's thankful this approach helped her get her life back, even though it's a different life than before her injury.
There is no such thing as a pain-free day for me. It never, never fully goes away.
She says she's just learned how to manage life with it. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Christine Herman.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. As a teenager, KFAI's Katie Thornton contracted Lyme disease. She experiences pain in her arms, neck, and back daily. And yet, she takes the chance of being in more pain by jumping on a skateboard. In this audio essay, she explains why.
My best guess is that I got bit by a tick when I was 12. I was camping in Wisconsin when my left knee started clicking with every step. A decade of weird, unpredictable pain followed. Finally, at age 23, I was diagnosed with Lyme disease. Lyme is an autoimmune disorder, so I don't recover well from injuries or illnesses. So these days, I'm 25, and my left knee still hurts. My back hurts. So does my left arm. Pretty often, it feels like there's someone inside of me, jabbing me with a hot stick, like they're stoking a fire. Multiple times a day, the pain stops me dead in my tracks, and I whimper. So why am I standing at the top of a slick wooden quarter pipe at Third Lair Skate Park in Golden Valley, ready to risk a fall and even more pain? Maybe it has something to do with the pain-relieving effects of adrenaline. Maybe it's just because I can. I'm a beginner and one of a growing number of women to show up on Mondays when women skate for free. Here, my heart beats loudly in my chest. My eyes dart from my board to the ramp to the obstacles in front of me. A preteen boy stands next to me on the ramp. He's a veteran of the sport. He's got some advice. I always say, focus, but don't think, he tells me. So I don't think about the pain. I don't think about the hours I spent with needles and sensors and scanners in and around my body. I don't think about the years I spent walking with a cane. Thinking leads to hesitation, and in this sport, hesitation is a surefire way to get hurt. Instead, I try to clear my mind, because there's nothing logical about skateboarding. Think of something as basic as dropping in, which is the first step of any run at a skate park. You have to will yourself to fall forward while trying to balance on a piece of wood on wheels. I probably stepped back off my board 80 times before plunging my body into what I swear was a deep abyss. In reality, it was only 2 feet high. It took me 3 tries to ride it out. I managed to stay on top of this board that desperately wanted to go at its own speed. I had subverted gravity. Learning to skate as an adult with chronic pain adds another layer of subversion, of tricking the world around me, and maybe even myself, into thinking I'm well. On a skateboard, I'm a trespasser in the terrain of the physically able. It was one of those surprisingly warm October days. Like a good Minnesotan, I fulfilled the weighty obligation to seize a nice day in late fall. I wrapped up work early and rode my bike across the river to an outdoor skate park in St. Paul. It was before 3 p.m. on a school day, which means, as it often does, that there were other grown-ups seeking refuge at the park. 2 men, probably in their late 30s. I introduced myself and got suited up. By now, I had moved on to some tricks. After plunging my body down the ramp, I rolled up a quarter pipe with enough speed to put my front wheels over the rounded metal edge of the ramp. When you do it right, you roll back the other way. The ramp cradles you and propels you toward the park's other features. When you do it wrong, your wheels get stuck above that metal edge. Your momentum stops. Gravity propels you straight down. I did it wrong. I dropped 5 feet and landed on my hip. One of the guys said, "That's gonna hurt tomorrow." For most skaters, this would have been a pretty routine fall. But with my body, it's meant new weekly visits to physical therapy and a daily exercise regimen. So why do I continue to risk it? Living with chronic illness has meant that the rest of my life has been complicated by pain, pills, and a labor-intensive diet designed to combat an invisible enemy. But I haven't gotten better. So living with illness means that the idea of effort leading to results has been obliterated. Skateboarding is the opposite. With practice, I can watch myself improve.
Katie, you have it.
Effort can actually lead to accomplishment.
Yes!
It's my middle finger to Lyme disease.
You should do it again. Try to make it true.
Oh, no, it's not going to happen.
My illness is chronic. That means it's not going away. But skateboarding reminds me that it's possible, if only for a few fleeting moments, to feel good in my body.
Oh, I tried. I can't do it. A community college in Western Massachusetts has opened a women's center. 51%'s Josh Landes brings us a piece about the new center at Berkshire Community College in Pittsfield. He starts by speaking with BCC President Ellen Kennedy in the Susan B. Anthony building.
We are here to open the Women's Center at Berkshire Community College. That has been a goal, a dream, a passion of Beth Wallace's since she experienced one herself in her finishing up her undergraduate degree, and it is something we've known we've needed for a long time. We've done a lot of programming around it, but we've never had a dedicated space.
Beth Wallace is the school's assistant dean of students. While minoring in women's studies, she worked in the Women's Center at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts in North Adams, about 20 miles north. When she came back to BCC in 2002, Wallace had a mission.
At the time, we weren't in a place at the college space-wise to open a women's center and have it be in an area where students would be. This past summer, we reconfigured two offices. As the dean, I was given this huge space, and it's the student engagement center, right? So what better place for a women's center? So I pulled together faculty, staff, and students for a committee to say, this is what we want to do. Let's make this happen.
BCC backed the plan and gave her startup money, roughly $1,400 for furniture, from its five-year strategic plan budget. Interest soon followed from the surrounding community.
After the election in 2016, I felt there was a loss that some young girls and women felt. I had a niece who was very upset by the results of the election, which got me thinking I need to talk to other women and make sure that young girls and women understand that hope isn't lost, that we've come a long way and we will continue to go further. And when I heard about the Women's Center opening, I thought that's a perfect place for me to be able to give back to what I felt some people gave to me along the way.
Karen Zink is president of Berkshire Gas Company. At the request of Ellen Kennedy, Zink became a part of the planning committee for the Women's Center from the first meeting. After decades of experiencing sexism in the corporate world, she was thrilled at what the center could offer the women of BCC.
They have a place to go if they have any concerns or if they have something they want to share that's, you know, whether it's positive or negative, that they have other people around them that they know that when they can speak openly, honestly, and not have a fear that there's going to be backlash for anything that they say. And again, share joy, share excitement, share progress that they make. So this is a positive thing.
Liliana Atanasio also spoke at the ceremony. She's an engineering student about to graduate from BCC.
Here we have a place where, and there are some other women here, you know, that we can share the conversation. And from there, from those kind of conversations, is the way you get what you need from other women.
Atanasio is a mother, an immigrant from Mexico, and wants to pursue a degree in the biomedical field after BCC. She sees the Women's Center and the space it provides as a crucial ingredient in her vision of the modern woman.
A woman who doesn't see any limitations. I feel like the world, it's out there, the opportunity is out there. Just go and work hard, because you have to work hard. You know, you have to pay a price, but it's totally worth it. I mean, that's how I raise my girls.
In a system of ingrained prejudices, she sees solidarity among women as vital.
And I'm a Latina, you know, I'm representing a minority. We are making less money than any woman in this country. So we need to help each other.
Her goals for the Women's Center?
Definitely that more women get empowered, that more women get involved, that more women feel the same way I feel. Like, yeah, I can do it.
Berkshire Community College has a student population of just under 2,000, 61% female. For 51%, I'm Josh Landes.
The STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, have traditionally been dominated by men, and that can make it tough for women to break in or gain respect. And even the Me Too movement is highlighting these issues, and some female professionals in the Great Lakes region have their own stories about the culture of gender bias. WBFO's Angelica Morrison has more for Great Lakes Today.
Inside the Great Lakes Center Field Station, which is just a few miles away from the Buffalo State campus, Alicia Perez Fuente Taha checks on a collection of tiny pet fish.
What are they? Are those pet shiners?
Yeah, well, that is a spot tail shiner.
The field station is where some of her research takes place. She's an aquatic ecologist known for her work with emerald shiners and the detection of antidepressants in the brains of fish from the Niagara River. She says as a woman, building a career in the sciences isn't easy.
When females around in the field would get pregnant or got married, the comments from the fellow males would be like, poof, she's out of the game now, or she's having kids, you can count on her now. Sort of like being a mother somehow affected your ability to do your work. And those comments are common, and sometimes they're pretty harsh.
Perez Fuente Taha says change begins to happen when women learn to speak up.
Another hurdle for women: if you're doing very well, a man would go speak to your dean and ask for a raise. A woman will not. Or if they ask for a raise, it's for a little tiny raise, not a big one, right?
In a recent survey of female STEM professionals who work in predominantly male environments, 78% say they've experienced discrimination. In that same Pew Research Group survey, close to 50% say they've experienced sexual harassment or their gender has made it hard for them to succeed in their field. Monica Deuce knows that feeling well. She's an assistant professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology at the University of Michigan. Back in her undergraduate years about a decade ago, she recalls a day when she was sent home because she was wearing pink boots. It was during a science program where she was showing high school students various experiments.
It was 8:30 a.m. and I was told I had to go change my pink shoes because it wasn't professional for a scientist to wear pink.
Unfortunately, the problems didn't stop with the color of her shoes. Now, she's uncomfortable repeating some of the things said to her over the years, but there's one experience she did share.
I was quite thin, and one of the male graduate students asked me if I got my periods because I was so thin.
University at Buffalo engineering professor Liesl Folks is working to combat some of these issues. She's leading a program aimed at giving students the tools to deal with gender bias. Right now, she's starting a session with a group of about 20 students.
A lot of time to think and reflect on what you learned at the retreat, and are all sort of energized for what we're going to learn today at the workshop.
She says all too often women in STEM choose to abandon their careers because of gender-based conflicts at work.
So what we see is it's very, very, very common for women when they hit these barriers to take that first step. They will usually take some kind of an action.
And the first step is to tell management or human resources.
If it turns out badly and that first action doesn't result in a positive change in their working environment, then often what they do is just go back to their office and say, I'm just going to avoid the situation, I'm going to work harder than I ever did, I'm going to do better work, and I will be recognized for my better work, and I'm just going to try and stay out of the way of whatever else is going on that's negative. But that ends up being soul-destroying.
Some of the skills she teaches in the program include forming alliances with coworkers. This will help provide support if something should happen. Also, before jumping ship, female STEM professionals should clearly evaluate all of their options. For WBFO News, this is Angelica Morrison.
Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of WBFO Buffalo, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Rochester. In many families, there's that one person who plays family historian. Eloise Briscoe of Philadelphia has claimed that role in her family, and she shared what connects the women in her lineage while speaking to Versify, a platform where people tell stories and then a writer turns their words into poetry. Joshua Moore introduces us to Briscoe and poet J. Joseph Kane.
When Eloise Briscoe sat down to share her story with us, she knew exactly the type of poem she was hoping for. A celebration of the women in her family that she could give as a gift to her mother.
And yet my mom is 91. She's been lingering in a place where she's kind of not longed for this world for a really long time, and I always have struggled with wanting to have some kind of wonderful word to leave, to say for on her behalf.
Eloise thinks of her mother and grandmother as women of simple gestures, who left their mark not by making the headlines, but by being present.
Two phrases I always think of when I think of my grandmother. She wanted us to do a favor for her. She goes, "If you do this for me, I'll dance at your wedding." Nice. Which was so sweet. And then the other thing she would always say is, if you said something sweet and she kind of delighted in it, she would say, "Isn't that grand?"
In contrast to these calm, understated women was Eloise's great-grandmother Emma, a suffragette, the boat rocker.
She was really kind of ahead of her time in terms of being a woman who took big stands on political matters and was not afraid to do big headline types of things.
Our culture appreciates people like Emma, who are seen as big doers. But never having rocked any boats herself, Eloise wonders what she has to pass along to her two daughters.
I feel the weight and pressure, or the weight and responsibility of knowing that I'm pouring something forward for them. But I don't know what it is, you know? But I hope it's just being present.
Poet Joe Kane observes, sometimes it's the simple things that leave the most lasting impact.
It's for, well, all the women of Eloise's family. My grandmother used to wipe her table clean. After a meal, she was on her feet until every crumb was gone. And yet, she didn't bat an eye when I unloaded a 5-year-old's armful of freshly picked dandelions on the polished wood. I burst into an explanation of how dandelions weren't weeds. They were flowers. And look, they have magic, I said, rubbing an open blossom along my arm. They have sunshine inside, and they'll give it to you. Oh, she said, a smile wrinkling the corner of her eyes. Isn't that grand? And touched a flower to her cheek. She let the yellow stain her dress and our hands. 2 sun children painting on a Sunday. I don't really know if it was a Sunday, but it seems like it should be, doesn't it? Here's what I want for you, my daughters. For memories to come to you like dreams or seasons. To know that the women of our family, like memories, return. Your great-great-grandmother was a suffragette, a World War I widow who needed to build her own road to travel. But she always told her family why she rocked the boats she rocked. Always built her road wide for us to follow. And my mother, not a boat rocker, but you never had to go far to find her. She was always ready for our stories, after school, what class was hardest, what book most made me rethink who I was. When I was in college and rethinking more than usual, she hopped on a plane to come visit me. That was the greatest gift she thought she could give, time spent together. It was the only thing she asked for. A lot like her mother, who, before any small favor, would say, "If you do this for me, I'll dance at your wedding." I would have loved any child, but there's a part of me that's glad to not have sons. Now that you're growing up, the greatest gift I want to give you is this time, my visit to your city, these hands, sometimes with a flower in them.
Since Eloise first heard this poem, her mother has passed away, but not before Eloise got the chance to share it with her. And on the day of her funeral, they read the poem in her honor. For Nashville Public Radio, I'm Joshua Moore.
Diversify Podcast is a partnership between Nashville's public radio station WPLN and The Porch, a nonprofit writing center, along with PRX. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1502.